Oh, yeah. That's a little bird.
This is Arlene Shapiro and Harold Kimball interviewing Mark Stern. This is tape two. Today is March 10th, 1986. Mark, would you tell us your address?
Again.
Mark Stern, 6332 Phillips, Pittsburgh, PA 15217.
Mark, last time we talked about your childhood and your home life and your life in Krakow. Could you tell us the population of Krakow? And do you know the approximate, was it a big city? Were there a lot of Jews, a large Jewish population?
Well, Krakow, first of all, was at one time the capital city of Poland. At that time, wasn't anymore, but was maybe the second biggest town in Poland with a fairly large Jewish population. The numbers I wouldn't remember, it was many years back when I was young, but the approximate maybe 250,000 Jews, from which half of them lived in ghetto-like area, especially the Orthodox lived there. That's where the shtiblech, the school, the synagogues were, and that's where the Hebrew high school that I went to was.
In the Orthodox section?
In the Orthodox section, right near there.
Were there other synagogues or temples that were not Orthodox at the time?
At that time they had the Orthodox, and they, from what I remember, they were also Orthodox, but they were more acceptable for the assimilated Jews. I think I mentioned that my father was fairly assimilated to the point that we lived in a non-Jewish neighborhood.
Right.
And he used to even work on Shabbos. But we children had to go to Hebrew school, and we had to live more observing way of life.
Did all of the Jewish children go to Hebrew schools or to schools with Jewish children attending? Were there integrated schools?
No. Most of the children went to the integrated schools, just like you have it here. There was few private schools. Some of the Orthodox Jewish children had to go to Cheder, which I'm sure is attended by many Orthodox children here too. But they were forced to go to either Hebrew school like mine, which was Tarbut school, where we learned the Sephardic Hebrew, or was the regular Polish school where the Jews and non-Jews went together.
Public education?
Public education, right.
It sounds like it was very much like our community today.
Well, that's right. As far as the education for children, it was very much like today's community. I don't remember synagogues having the afternoon schools the way we do now. I remember only there were haters. There were the little rooms where the rabbi used to teach his flock, his children, few children. They were
and the children from public school went to Haida?
And the ones that went to public school to get their education went to Haida. Right.
In business, your father did a lot of business with people who weren't Jewish. Socially, were the Jews and non-Jews friends also?
My father basically did business mostly with non-Jews. The friends was a different life. It was a different life. You're trying to bring my memory back, and I never thought of that question.
I guess I'm trying to compare it to what we know here.
And I can understand, but we had a different family life. The Jewish family was closer together. We constantly met with our uncles and aunts and cousins. I mean, it was a constant contact. When you had friends, you basically, your first friends were your family, of your age, younger or older. Otherwise, the friendships that were developed with your neighbors. Since I lived in a non-Jewish neighborhood, my friends mostly were non-Jewish. I thought they were my friends till the war broke out. And then I found out differently, but I can presume only that the ones that lived in Jewish neighborhoods had only Jewish friends. As a matter of fact, it had to be this way, because I remember that every time we went on vacation, and I was referring to the vacation time with my grandmother, which was a little Hasidic town. Mm-hmm. And there, my friends were only Jewish. Mm-hmm. And we maintain ties with Jewish people of our age through our school. Because I went to Hebrew school, I was active in the Jewish Scouts, which they called Hatzofer in that time. And I worked myself up to be one of the leaders in the movement. And the same way as the young people of today want to be active in the Scouts, I was active in the Scouts, but there were Jewish Scouts.
Was that like a USY youth group type of
school? No, it was approved Scout movement.
Like the Boy Scouts?
Like the Boy Scouts.
Did the girls have Scouts. A group like that too?
That's right. But they were called Hebrew names because we were Hebrew school. Hmm. We had a different... You know, we wore uniforms to go to school, just like the army uniforms. Our jackets were buttoned all the way up to the neck. We had to walk straight because otherwise you would choke. We had to wear hats, which were uniform hats. But this is the way you went to school there.
Public schools didn't wear uniforms.
No, public school didn't, but the private school.
Were there scout groups that were Jewish and non-Jewish? Were they, so they really weren't?
That's right. There were Jewish and non-Jewish scout groups. I don't know if it is acceptable in the United States, but I know that our synagogue at Shalom had a scout troop, and I presume they were mostly Jewish children because it was connected with the synagogue. We were connected with the Hebrew school, so we were only Jewish because mm-hmm. it was part of our curriculum, so to say.
But there were mixed groups.
Not in our school. There were...
Not in your school, but
oh,
in
yeah,
the city.
Outside, in the city,
city like,
sure.
People did...
There were many Jewish people that were so assimilated that they didn't speak any Hebrew, they didn't get any education. Let's not kid ourselves. The same way as today, you have children that don't even know that they are Jewish because mm-hmm. their parents choose not to give them this kind of a background. Mm-hmm. There were some children like this in my town.
I think it's important for us to understand that because I think sometimes we think of the Polish yeah. and German Jews of the time living in ghettos and living a life that's centered more around Judaism and not being as much of our life today.
Well, I compare Squirrel Hill closest to the ghetto type of life that was led in Poland,
in
Krakow. Because they are mostly Jews, not all Jews. But to me, when you walk around and you want to see kosher stores, you go to Squirrel Hill.
Mm-hmm, true.
When you wanted to find kosher butchers and kosher food, you went to Kazimierz, which was the Jewish ghetto in Krakow. Mm-hmm. So this was the closest that I came to it. Mm-hmm. I lived in Brooklyn, and they had a Jewish section. And but it wasn't as distinct. To me, it wasn't as distinct as the one here in Square Hill. This is why I liked it.
Can I ask a question? How about the level of the homes? Were they as nice as like Squirrel Hill?
I was going to
comparatively.
Ask
you, yeah.
Can you
in
tell us
Krakow,
more about your home?
All right. In Krakow, where we lived in a modern section. Our homes were three-story buildings. It was an apartment. My father was building right maybe 3 years or 4 years before the war broke out. His plan was to build our private home, which would be just like private homes here in Squirrel Hill. And the ghetto, Jewish ghetto, was built long time before I was born. And when you walked in there, you could feel this antiquity, this old, narrow streets that the cars, in many areas, the cars couldn't pass through. The little marketplaces in some areas, you could see that this was an old city, and even housing was like that too. And they were not modern, there was no more outhouses, but their outhouses were built within the homes,
in
within
the
buildings. Yes,
but not where you lived.
Yeah, no, not we had water closets. We were very modern. Mm-hmm. We had built the bathrooms and bathtubs. Usually in the older homes, you have to understand, we talked about 50 years ago. So 50 mm-hmm. years ago, if you wanted to take a bath in some of those homes, you had to pull out the tub out of the closet and fill it up with hot water, mm-hmm. and you took it. I'm sure you saw it in the movies with the cowboys. So this is the kind of a life they led. And sinks you didn't have in some of these homes. This brings to the point, this again, this little town that I used to go to my grandmother. They had over there what they called Wasserträger. Wasserträger is a man that was carrying the water to the homes. They had a barrel right outside the house, and a man was coming every day to fill up that barrel with water. Mm-hmm. And if you go to the marketplace, you saw that big well where he used to fill up those pails mm-hmm. and put them across his shoulders, two pails, and walk around. You might have seen it in pictures on the ice or in life. So the life without the modern way, the way we do with water running through the house, was different. You used to wait out in the morning and listen for the voice of the man that was selling the coal and the man that was bringing the ice for the ice box. That's a different life. And a small town was a charming life of very simple people who were learned in a different way than we were learned.
Do we assume there's electricity?
No, I wouldn't assume that. In some places they had electricity, but not every place.
In the small towns?
In small towns.
But in Krakow, probably?
In Krakow, yes.
Even
yes.
in the ghetto? I mean,
oh, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
You have to establish the year.
Oh, yes, we
this
are.
This is 19... I'm talking about 1936, 37, 38, 39.
What about the interiors of the homes, the furnishings? Were they simple? Were they elaborate? I know that... You
in my home... was elaborate. And my home, of course, we didn't have gas, so we were heating the home with wood or coal, and there was a couple, again, I'm going to the language that you wouldn't understand, it was a stove built in the kitchen that you use the coal to cook on. Mm-hmm. And the living room and bedroom, there was one oven that you heated it up with coal. You put coal and you burned the coal, and then the oven was getting hot, was the whole height of the wall. And before you went to sleep, you took your bed covers and held it against the oven to warm it up, and then you went into the bed, and when you woke up in the morning, everything was cold. You had to mm-hmm. wait till the maid put the heat on, mm-hmm. so to say, made the fire. Mm-hmm. These things I still remember.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
It's different life. You know, it's. I think that the young people of today miss a lot not knowing this mm-hmm. type of life.
Well, some people didn't even have that.
No,
right.
You're right. In some places, the only heating was in the kitchen, mm-hmm. and
would this be in the small towns more?
In the small
not
towns.
Not in the ghettos, were there?
In the ghettos, they had problems too. They had pot stove, the little metal made. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to describe mm-hmm. what a pot stove. Pot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what pot stove is,
yeah,
right? It's almost like a fireplace. The only thing that instead open the pipes from that were going into the kitchen, mm-hmm. so this way into the main mm-hmm. chimney. This is the kind of a life it was.
Was there a lot of commerce in Krakow? Clothing business, furniture business? Did you
oh, yes.
meet people?
Oh yes, there were big businesses. Businesses were all over, and although I was very young, I knew it and I saw it. And when you wanted
were
to buy something,
were people fashion conscious? Were they conscious of decorating their homes?
Well, you're talking about fashion conscious.
I guess I'm talking
you're talking about something
people.
Else. Fashion conscious is iconic, what tailor did you have? Because you didn't go to the store, department store, and picked your dress. You looked at the catalog and you picked what you want your dressmaker to make. Men and women, and when you talk about ghetto, that's where the women were sewing. Part of learning for the woman was to maintain the house and to wash the laundry and to sew the dresses. Mm-hmm. And it was a different kind of life. It was a very important part of her life. Mm-hmm. So it's different, definitely different.
When you went to Jaslo?
Jaslo. Jaslo is fine.
Okay. After the Germans took over your business, did many Jews stay in Krakow at that time? And were you one of the first to leave because you were alerted when they took your business?
I was one of very few that went away.
What happened to the Jews who stayed? Were they sent to Jaslo afterwards, or were they sent to ghettos? Or?
You have to understand, we're talking about big Poland. Jaslo, we lived in a small town next to Jaslo. Jaslo was a very small town. My mentality was to get away from this for simple reason that I had a blow of, firstly, seeing my father run away from at home and winding up in the Russian occupation and being sent to Siberia because he wanted to come back. We knew about it. So this is one thing. We knew that our father, that my father will not come back for a while because the Russians sent him out to Siberia. I was the one that was trying to keep the life in our home by supporting my mother and my sister. And at the age of 16, it was a difficult job, and when they took away the business of my father, I was crushed. And the only decision I could make is to get away to the town that I recognize as small town, thinking that, I mean, they can't be everywhere.
You thought it was safer there?
My imagination was that they are mainly watching the big towns. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that they had in every town somebody. I didn't know at that time about the Volksdeutsche. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't imagine that Germans would have enough people to cover every little town. It was the mentality of a young man who didn't know what the war was about. All he knew that we lost all our rights and that we better run away from here because it's going to get worse. Because it comes to the point that take away everything from you, we got to get away from it. And feeling the strong responsibility of my mother and my sister, who was 2 years older than me, I felt this is the thing to do.
Did the Jews in Krakow get sent to camps sooner than the Jews in small towns?
No.
Were they rounded up and put into a camp?
No, they rounded it up sooner than in other places as far as I knew. Mm-hmm. Shortly after I left, from what I understand, they created a ghetto.
In the ghetto.
In the ghetto. Mm-hmm. They closed off that area and they moved everybody from wherever they lived into the small area.
So then they had the same situation that you then had.
That's right. And I felt that I did the right thing because I wasn't moved by them. I moved voluntarily to where I felt more comfortable. Then, of course, it didn't take much longer, and they took us and moved us to a smaller ghetto in that small town.
When you were in the ghetto, and you mentioned you were working for the Gestapo in the house, you mentioned that in the cellar or in the basement there were cages that you didn't tell us what they were used for.
It was a very frightening experience.
But were they really used? And
they were used. I saw a couple people in them, and they were torturing them.
Why? What reasons? I mean, what did they want from them?
What reasons they had?
Did they want information?
Maybe they were collaborators with the partisans. Maybe they were partisans. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I am sure that some of them innocently wound up there. And the other ones, maybe they caught him trying to sabotage him. Everybody knew that the sabotage against the German was done from the beginning of the war, throughout the war. And all I knew that I saw people who were actually tortured. Mm-hmm. And this was nothing to compare with what was coming after. Mm-hmm. It was scary because I thought that I would never get out from there alive since I saw it. I thought that since I saw it, they're going to make sure that the witness won't stay alive, so this was the end. Mm-hmm. And you pay price for being acknowledged as, so to say, leadership, because our family was the leadership in that town, because my grandfather was a rabbi there, and the people had respect for the family. They knew I come from a big town, from high school, and they didn't get this kind of education. So they looked forward to the people like us to be on the kahal, on the leadership. I was too young. I wasn't even in leadership. I was just available if they needed somebody. As a matter of fact, I went in business with a couple of friends that I knew from there. Our business was to move people. He had a horse and a wagon, and, mm-hmm. and I had a strong back in the mm-hmm. ghetto. And I had a strong back, and the three of us were walking around, and whoever wanted, you know, people had to move from one area to another.
In the ghetto, within the ghetto. Yeah, they moved from one place to another.
And we made a few dollars to buy food, mm-hmm. or we got some food for that.
Why would they move from one place to another?
Because the accommodations were so tight, and if you heard that somebody had a little lodge and you had some money or some diamonds or some whatever they were buying, they were trading, and people tried to survive in every situation. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anything, because the things that I brought with me didn't last long.
So you worked if you could.
I was trying to make sure that I have some money to support my... I took it seriously. I mean, I had to give food to my family. I was the man of the house. Mm-hmm.
Could you tell a little more about the kahal, the leadership group, so the people...
The leadership group, you know, the people... I know some people look down, and I'm sure they are right to some of the leadership, because some of the leadership was very selfish in some areas. I think we spoke about it last time.
But it was a hard job.
It was a tough job, because on one hand you had to deal with the Germans, and you had to be sure that you don't become influenced. In the town that I lived in, I have to admit they were not influenced by the Germans. They were very kind people. They were people that were thinking only of how to avoid confrontation by giving the Germans whatever they wanted. So maybe somebody that they walked into their house and they said, listen, we need whatever sheets you have for beds, because the Germans want 100 sheets, so you have to give me because we heard that you have, and somebody else whatever. Because basically they were getting some of stuff like this here for the Germans. The other part, if the Germans said that they need a working force of people, they were the ones that had to say, well, listen, your son is a strong man, and he should go to work, and why my son? You know, this kind of a situation. I mean, I worked on the labor right from the first day that they requested, mm-hmm. because they knew that I was working with the other guys. So the day that they started the labor force requirements by the Germans, the kahal, the leaders, went to people that they knew they were working for a living, that they had strength and they were able to. So they put me on the group that was working on the roads, were breaking stones and rebuilding the roads and mm-hmm. for the Germans, and every morning you had to go to work. And for that you got some money. Mm-hmm. So I was able to maintain mm-hmm. the family. Mm-hmm. Some people didn't like it, obviously.
Yeah. Was there any medical care? What happened when people got sick in the ghetto?
Oh, there were some doctors around. There was no medicine per se, but they had enough quinine and some other things that were needed to maintain people from getting very sick.
How long were you in the ghetto?
I can only estimate that it was no more than 6-7 months.
And then
because then they took us and they put us into the labor camps and they moved everybody out of town in these boxcars.
The next question sounds kind of silly in a way, but there are children there and people are under a lot of stress. Was there anything that people could do to break the tension? Did children play at all? Was there anything, was there such a thing as a recreation, which is a strange word to use in this situation?
There was no organized recreation.
What about unorganized? Could people, did people play musical instruments?
You weren't allowed to get together. There was
children. What about children?
Children or anybody. Children, everybody was afraid to have children. And when you had children, you hid them because you were afraid what they're going to do to the children. They weren't as visible.
Mm-hmm.
The children that were visible were mostly my age. They were 17. And they were around, and then there was, of course, curfew. So you finished working, you came back before you had a chance to go and to socialize, which we did some. My first love was in ghetto. I met a girl that I thought that this was it, and she was a sister of one of the guys that I hanged around with. And she was one of them that was sent in the boxcars. Her and my sister, I was trying to hide in the second small ghetto that when they moved us. And before you knew, both of them were sent away. Mm-hmm. And again, at that age, I was alone.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you'd like to add to tell us that we should know about ghetto life?
In the ghetto, you lived hoping for the end of it. You always hoped. It's very difficult to think that, but it's funny that I never had an opportunity to think about the ghettos. But now that you're asking me, the flashback is how we loved each other, how my friends were the most important to me, how my family was my biggest worry. I never worried about me. I was worrying about my family. I loved the people that I was with because it was the closest that we live with. I wasn't experienced in this kind of a life. Our life, as you heard before, was in a big town, separated, and the only connection that I had is through the school that I went to, that we became friends in within the Jewish circles. Over there was a truly Jewish life, and I could appreciate the people that were very orthodox, like my cousins there, this pace that I described to you in Kapotas, and this importance of this kind of a life to me created love for that. I really felt that now that you're saying it, that possibly my love for Judaism comes from that period. Because this is where I really, really lived Jewishly. I really lived with the people that knew what Shabbat was, how it is to observe Shabbat, in spite of being forced to work on Shabbat. But you knew there was a Shabbat on Friday evening. You knew that it's coming up because the whole town, even in this close quarters, tried to shine up and clean up whatever they had and get ready for this festive morning. And of course, I told you I lost my grandmother, and that funeral was an experience that made for me deep understanding of the death, of losing somebody that you love, and also feeling that you didn't lose them because they will be always with you because you thought of them. So this was the kind of a strength that you were able to get from that. I guess it was a positive period of life because it gave me a positive attitude toward my being Jewish.
Isn't that something?
I never realized it until you started asking about it, and I'm recalling these things that were happening.
Did they organize a synagogue type of service on, or prayer service on Shabbat?
Everybody was praying, but they were praying in very small groups, so we wouldn't be noticed.
Did people try to observe kashrut?
We always observe.
In the ghetto?
In the ghetto.
We observed kashrut up to the day that we went into the camp, and you had to eat whatever you were given.
That's right.
Because, well, there were people that observed kashrut in the camp too. I saw people dying from hunger because they couldn't get anything but bread and coffee that was kosher. Everything else wasn't, and they wouldn't accept it. Mm. And you didn't get enough of it as it is.
Mm-hmm. From the ghettos, you were sent to a camp?
From the ghetto, they took us first to a smaller area because they cut down from the number of people, which was, and again, I'll be guessing, thousands, maybe 4, 5, maybe 6, 8, I don't know, to, there was first about 500 of us, and they put us into a very small area under very strict supervision, and then they were cleaning up the ghetto, using us to bury people, to pick him out of the street and to take him and to bury them. And then they took only, don't remember exact number, but it was less than 100. Mm-hmm. And they put us into a closed area where we work in a mill, taking big trees and cutting them into board. Right near Yaslo.
Oh.
I don't even remember the name of the town.